You're with SBS Radio.
Tungandame on NITV Radio, and I'm in conversation with Rihanna Patrick, a Torres Strait Islander media professional who will be moderating a panel discussion at the upcoming World Science Forum later this month in Brisbane. One of the questions that participants will attempt to answer is, why aren't we listening to Indigenous peoples on climate change? Rihanna Patrick joined us to try and unpack some of the reasons behind the reticence to hear First Nations voices on climate change. First of all, Rihanna, welcome to NITV Radio.
Oh, thank you for having me.
The event will be COVID safe, and the first questions we ask nowadays is, how are you doing in this time of great pandemic?
Yeah, look, I think I'm adjusting pretty well to working from home at the moment. And I would say, I don't know, I might be different to other people, Bertrand, in that I've really enjoyed kind of being away from an office and kind of just working from home. So, you know, while it has been hard in terms of not catching up with community and not catching up with others, you know, I recognise that we're in the middle of a pandemic, and so being safe is kind of my number one priority. So, yeah, I think I've been doing quite well.
Yeah, and let's go straight into the topic of the day, the First Nations scientists connecting culture with science. And one of the questions that is being asked is, why aren't we listening to Indigenous people on climate change?
This is a really interesting, Bertrand, because I wanted to approach this in terms of talking about rising tides and searing heat and putting a focus also on the Torres Strait, which is obviously dealing with the issue of rising tides right now. And so for me, and what I wanted to do with that panel was to kind of highlight that this is happening, because it feels as though very few people are listening to that. While there's been some media coverage of the Torres Strait 8 lodging their claim to the UN against the Australian government, against what they say is affecting their human rights of being able to continue to live where they live, I don't think there has been as much coverage as I would have thought that a case like this would have garnered, in terms of its, you know, the case is the first of its kind in the world. They're the first Indigenous group to take this kind of action against against the government in their country. And so I wanted to really highlight that, but I also wanted to find out sort of what else is happening, and particularly, you know, tying in those relationships that we have with the Aboriginal community as well, of understanding what else is happening that we might not be seeing either within the Indigenous community, because it's not being talked about either.
Now, why aren't Indigenous voices being heard in terms of climate change? I remember this question was asked last year, because this time last year it wasn't the pandemic, we're just coming out of some of the most devastating bushfires in the country. And the role of Indigenous knowledge in tackling climate change was raised at that time and came into prominence. But why aren't Indigenous voices heard?
You know, I think there's been a lot of talk around that. I mean, those bushfires, I mean, were absolutely devastating to watch from Queensland, which is where I'm based. And I think, you know, there were a lot of conversations that I was reading about around that, around, you know, and just trying to check in to see also how a lot of those communities were recovering as well after the bushfires. And one of the things that I've wondered about is why we're not hearing more about climate change that is affecting those parts of the country that is Australia closer to home, in a way, as well. And, you know, I think one of the things I wanted to highlight in this panel of rising tides and searing heat was really putting some emphasis on what is happening in the Torres Strait, because while there has been some level of media coverage, it seems that it's not as visible as I think it should be for a case where, you know, a group of Torres Strait Islanders have decided to take their claims to the United Nations about their human rights being impacted on. And, you know, it's the first case of its kind in the world. They're the first Indigenous group to lodge a UN human rights claim, which encompasses climate change against the federal government. And I think it's interesting that for something that is part of Australia, we're not hearing enough about that. You know, and these are islands which I have connections to, not necessarily the islands that are part of Torres Strait 8, but, you know, I understand why they are taking their case to the UN and why they've lodged this case in the first place, because what is happening up there, I think, is the fact that communities are concerned that they may be moved on, that they may be forced to leave their islands. And islands are not just where you live, they're not just the place that you call home, they're your connection to bloodline, they're your connection to culture, they're your connection to your songs and dances, they're a connection to a whole range of things, including how you interact with the environment and how you adapt to those changes in environment. And, you know, just from some of the things that I've been hearing is, you know, when you've got graves which are being flooded and remains being washed away and the bones of your old people having to be moved, or the changes to where you bury your old people, you know, to water, well water being affected on some islands, you know, these long droughts are affecting things like growing crops. There's when you talk to certain people who know about those weather patterns from the islands that they're from, you know, they've noticed these changes of winds, you know, blowing longer from different directions where they might not have blown as long from. You know, there's always this worry around monsoon season for some of those islands that have already experienced flooding of what does that mean? But also, you know, what do these storm surges mean when you might lose not a metre of beach, you might lose 3 or 4 metres in a few hours. So these are kind of the concerns that Torres Strait 8 has been trying to raise about particularly the islands that they come from, of Boigu, Masig, Purama and Waterbear. And it just seemed to me as though, you know, we probably need to listen a little bit more to what Indigenous Australians are saying, but particularly Indigenous peoples around the world.
I've been covering these environmental issues for many, many years now, and especially covering the COP21 in Paris and the one after in Marrakech and so on. And we saw a very impassioned actually interventions from Pacific Island nations really highlighting that with the environmental crisis that we're just heading into head on is going to actually render them the faster climate refugees in the future. And yet hardly anything said about closer to home actually, the Torres Strait Islands. Why is that?
Look, I don't know why that is, you know, but I think, you know, we are, when you think about us in terms of population, we're a small population for those living in the islands. There are much more of us that live here on the mainland. But when we think about those that are going to have to leave their homes because of climate change, I mean, the thing is that Torres Strait Islanders have been here before and we've already really had our first climate change migration, which was back in the late 40s after World War II, when there were several families of Saibai Islanders, which is sort of northwest region of the Torres Strait. They're about 5 kilometres, that island's about 5 kilometres from Papua New Guinea. But there were families in the 1940s that left because of the damage of sort of a number of king tides that had happened, and they relocated to the tip of Cape York. And that's why we have those towns of Bamaga and Saithia, which exist, because that's where those families ended up relocating to, which was supposed to be temporary at first, but it became permanent. And so, you know, this is a history that already exists for Torres Strait Islanders, and it's one that I grew up knowing about. My dad grew up in Bamaga, so I've always known about that history of Saibai Islanders coming to Bamaga and how that town was built and how that town came to be existed. But I think, you know, we sometimes, if it's history that we don't know of as the wider community, we can sometimes forget that there have been things that have happened before. And I mean, this isn't, you know, the Torres Strait aren't the first to highlight the problems of climate change in the Torres Strait. We've had many, many decades of people raising this situation with the UN as well and with other Indigenous groups around the world and talking about this quite actively for a number of decades now. And I don't want to mention all of those people in case I leave some of those people out, and some of those people have passed who have been a part of that movement. But I mean, that movement has continued up until now, which is you know, seeing the Torres Strait 8 take this submission to the UN. And I mean, we're expecting that verdict will be known maybe sometime mid this year. But, you know, it needs to be said also that when they lodged this case back in May 2019, by sort of August last year, the government had actually asked the UN to dismiss this claim on the grounds that it couldn't be held individually responsible for climate change because it's a global problem. But I think the problem is that the Torres Strait and the water rising in the Torres Strait is happening at what seems to be double the worldwide rate at the moment. And for a lot of those islands that have lodged this claim that are sandy caves, it's going to take probably years, not decades, you know, for their islands to be impacted, which is why this is such a critical situation and why I think more people need to be thinking about it. And it's, you know, it's one of those things where it's not only about bringing visibility to this case, but I think it's about people understanding exactly what all of this means and what it will mean if these islands are impacted as such that people have to move to the mainland. I mean, where are they going to go?
Well, as you said, there's a little coverage of the situation in the media. But besides the submission to the United Nations, what other actions have the peoples of the Torres Strait Islands taken to raise awareness about the impending climate disaster?
I think that's part of what the campaign that's been launched, which was launched last year, Our Islands, Our Home.com.au. That is what that campaign is largely about, is about bringing visibility to this, to the Torres Strait 8 case, bringing visibility to the impact of climate change in the Torres Strait, and trying to inform the rest of Australia that this isn't happening in countries in the Pacific. It's actually happening on your doorstep, but yeah, also that those that produce, you know, the less carbon emissions, you know, in the country are the ones that are impacting, and they're on the front line of what everyone else is producing at the moment. You know, and I think what the Torres Strait 8 are also asking for from the UN is that, you know, that, you know, Australia increases its emission reduction targets by 2023, and they kind of want to see a net zero target by 2050, and also phasing out coal. And, I mean, this is, you know, part of their push is to show that this isn't, climate change isn't something that's just in the future for them. This has been happening for a number of decades now. People have been noticing those changes, but the changes are starting to become more rapid. You know, islands are becoming inundated more often. Erosion is eating away at some of these islands. And we need to, you know, it's critical that we start looking at what the situations are. And while there has been money that has been put into seawalls, a lot of those seawalls are no longer working anymore in helping those islands keep the sea out for some of those low-lying islands. So I think it's, you know, while it is a global problem, this is something that is happening on our doorstep that we need to be aware of and we need to be advocating for too, because it's going to start in the Torres Strait, but if you live anywhere on the coast, this will also impact you.
Yeah, and this is part of the discussions that you will be moderating at the World Science Festival between the 24th and the 28th of March. Rayana Patrick, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you so much.
Want to hear more stories like this? Listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.